This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Center for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
The night sky for March 2017. Well, as darkness falls, that lovely region of the sky around the Orion constellation, Taurus up to its right, Gemini up to its left, is beginning to set towards the western horizon. And you might just see Sirius low above the southwestern horizon as they gradually fall into the west. The three stars of Orion's belt, as I'm sure you know, if you follow them upwards, you come to the Hyades cluster and beyond the Pleiades cluster in Taurus, and then down to the lower left to Sirius in Canis Major. Fairly high up now, to the upper left of Orion, is Gemini, the heavenly twins with the two stars Castor above and Pollux below. Then there's a fairly empty, apparently, part of the sky moving over towards the south, the constellation of Cancer. But with binoculars you can see a rather lovely little cluster called M45, the Beehive Cluster, or Praesepe. And then further over we have one of the other great constellations of the northern sky, Leo, with its bright star Regulus. That will come up in one of the highlights this month. And then gradually, as the evening moves on, Virgo, with Spica, its brightest star, very close in fact to Jupiter, is rising in the southeast. Slightly higher up, over in the east, a bright star called Arcturus, part of the constellation of Bootes. And then slightly to the north and almost overhead, we've got Ursa Major with its two stars, Merak and then Dubhe, pointing towards Polaris, the pole star. If you look at the central, quote, star of the handle of the plough with a telescope, you'll find that in fact Mizar, the brighter, is in fact a double star. And between it and the second star of the little group called Alcor, it's a little reddish star, quite faint, but makes a nice little open triangle. So quite a lot to see still in the sky tonight and during the month. What about the planets? Jupiter is moving towards opposition on April 7th, and that's when it's due south around midnight-ish UT, but of course we'll be in British summertime then. It lies in Virgo, initially some 4 degrees above the brightest star, Spica. At the start of March, it rises in the east at about 22:45, but by month's end, by about 20:45. It'll be due south at an elevation of 34 degrees at about 0200 at the start and near midnight UT by the end of March. The size of Jupiter's disk increases slightly from 42 to 44 arc seconds as we close towards it. And the magnitude increases very slightly from minus 2.3 to minus 2.5. And of course, with a small telescope, one should easily be able to see the equatorial bands in the atmosphere, sometimes the great red spot, and up to 4 of the Galilean moons as they weave their way around it. Well, Saturn. Saturn rises well after midnight and will be highest in the pre-dawn sky. Lying in the western part of Sagittarius, its diameter increases from 16.2 to 17 arc seconds during the month, as it shines at a pretty constant magnitude of plus 0.5. It'll be high enough in the southeast before dawn to make out the beautiful ring system, which at over 26 degrees to the line of sight are as open as they ever become. If only it were higher in the ecliptic. Its elevation this year never gets above 18 degrees, and so the atmosphere will hinder our view of this most beautiful planet. Mercury passes through superior conjunction on March the 7th. That means it passes between the Earth and the Sun. It becomes visible around the 15th in the bright twilight just above the western horizon. On the 19th, on its way up in the sky, it passes Venus on its way down, some 9 degrees to its right. Then, at magnitude minus 1.4, gradually, its brightness drops to about minus 0.4 by the end of the month. with an angular size which actually only ever gets up to about 7.3 arc seconds by the end of the month, you don't expect to see any details on the surface. Mars is easy to find as March begins, lying in Pisces up and to the left of Venus, some 13 degrees down to its lower right. As the month progresses, Mars continues to move eastwards. It moves into Aries on the 8th, while Venus falls back towards the western horizon. Its brightness falls slightly during the month from magnitude plus 1.3 to plus 1.5, while its angular diameter falls from 4.6 to 4.1 arc seconds. And of course, no details will be expected to be seen on its salmon pink surface. Well, finally, Venus. Well, it starts the month dominating the western sky, shining virtually at its brightest with a magnitude of minus 4.8. It lies due south in mid-afternoon. It can even be seen with the unaided eye if you know where to look. After dark, in a very dark location, it can even form faint shadows. On the 1st of March, it has its highest elevation at sunset, about 30 degrees. But then, as the month progresses, it falls back towards the sun as it passes in front of it, that's inferior conjunction, on the 25th. Its angular size is increasing from 48 to 59 arc seconds during this time, but at the same time, the phase reduces from 16% down to just 1% illuminated. And the two effects basically compensate each other, which is why the brightness doesn't change very much, at about minus 4.1. Very unusually, Venus is far enough north of the Sun that it will start rising before dawn on March the 15th, some 10 days before inferior conjunction. Thus it could be seen for a short while, both at nightfall and also at dawn. That's quite unusual. Invisible light, no details are seen on its brilliant white surface, but you can see some cloud details in the ultraviolet. So finally, what about some highlights? Well, the first few days of March, and particularly the first, there are three planets, and on the first, along with a very thin crescent moon. So if it's clear, I must say we haven't had many clear nights over the last few weeks. Looking southwest, one could not fail to spot Venus. But on these nights, Venus is about 12 or 13 degrees down to the lower right of Mars, and between them lies Uranus. As I said, on the 1st of March, they'll be adjoined by a very thin, waxing crescent moon. Now, quite nicely, on the 4th of March, at around 10 p.m, the full moon occults Gamma Tauri in the Hyades cluster. Gamma Tauri forms the peak of the triangular-shaped cluster. Now, due to parallax, the timings of the occultation vary somewhat across the UK, but nevertheless, it will be a nice thing to try and look out for if it's clear. Now, after the moon has set here, but visible across much of the USA, the moon will occult Aldebaran, which is bright. It's not actually part of the cluster, it lies between our sun and the cluster. From a thin strip from Hartford in the east to Vancouver in the west, a grazing occultation will be seen, with Aldebaran disappearing and reappearing many times as its light passes through the valleys lying along the moon's limb. On the 10th of March, all evening, the moon, 2 days before full, closes on Regulus in Leo. On the 15th of March, before dawn, the moon lies close to Jupiter and Spica, making a nice triangle, actually. So Jupiter will lie between the moon to its upper left and Spica, Alpha Virginis, down to its lower left. On March the 20th, before dawn, Saturn will lie close to the third quarter moon. So looking south, it should be seen over to the right of the moon. I usually point out something on the moon that you could see with a small telescope. And on the 6th of March and the 19th, the Alpine Valley lies close to the Terminator. You'll see the Apennine mountain chain that marks the edge of Mare Imbrium, and towards the upper end you should see a cleft across them, which is called the Alpine Valley. It's about 7 miles wide and 79 miles long. In fact, a thin rill runs along its length. That's pretty hard to see. The dark crater may also be visible nearby. And you may also see the shadow cast by the mountain Mons Piton, lying not far away in Mare Imbrium. Actually, it's a very interesting region of the moon. I know the nights are drawing in a bit, but still there's plenty to see in the heavens, and I hope we have some clear nights so you can enjoy it.
Thanks for that, Ian. And for our Antipodean listeners, here's Claire Bretherton with the night sky where you are.
Kia ora, and welcome to the March Jodcast from Space Place at Carter Observatory here in Wellington, New Zealand. As we approach the autumn equinox on the 20th of March, our evenings are quickly drawing in. Whilst unfortunately this means that the colder winter weather will soon be on its way, not that we'll be able to tell much difference with the summer we've been having here in Wellington, it also means we have more time to get outside observing our beautiful southern skies. The Milky Way, or Te Ikaroa, arches high across the sky from north-northwest to south-southeast after dark. Over the last few months we've been looking at interesting objects lying along the plane of our galaxy, but this month we're going to turn our attention a little to either side. Canopus, the second brightest star in our night-time sky at magnitude -0.74, is just to the southwest of overhead. To Maori, it is known either as Ariki, meaning high-born, or as Atutahi or Aotahi, meaning stand-alone, because of its position set apart from the Milky Way. Canopus is circumpolar from our position here, and is considered to be a tapu, or sacred star to Maori. A little below Canopus, around halfway down the sky towards the southwest, is bright blue Akana, a main sequence star around 7 times more massive than the Sun, but over 3,000 times more luminous. Akana is part of a binary system, with a fainter, less massive A-type companion at a distance of 12.3 AU. The two orbit each other in approximately 14 years. Akana spins extremely fast on its axis, in fact so fast that it has flattened out to an oblate spheroid shape rather than a sphere, with the diameter of its equator measuring over 50% larger than its polar diameter. Akana and Canopus form a roughly equilateral triangle with the southern celestial pole, the point in the sky right above the south pole of the Earth, about which the sky appears to rotate as the Earth spins on its axis. Unlike the northern hemisphere, we have no nearby bright star to mark this point, so we have to estimate it from the surrounding stars. Perhaps the easiest way to find the southern celestial pole is to look for Crux, the Southern Cross, high in the southeast this month with the pointers Alpha and Beta Centauri below. Simply point one hand at Gamma Crucis at the short end of the cross and the other at Akana and bring them together in the middle, and you should be close to this point. Dropping your hands down to the horizon will then give you south. Not far from the southern celestial pole back towards Akana, you may be able to spot two small fuzzy patches of light, easily seen with the naked eye on a dark moonless night. These are the large and small Magellanic clouds, two small irregular dwarf galaxies that neighbour our own. Whilst these galaxies are much smaller than the Milky Way, combined they still contain billions of stars. The Large Magellanic Cloud, or LMC, is the higher of the two and is located 160,000 light-years away. Look out for a number of young star clusters visible as small patches of light in binoculars or a small telescope. Smaller and more distant at around 200,000 light-years is the Small Magellanic Cloud, or SMC. A bridge of gas connects the two clouds, evidence of a tidal interaction between the two. The best time to look out for these galaxies is around the new moon on the 28th of the month, when they will be high in the south after dark. The pointers, Alpha and Beta Centauri, are the first and second brightest stars in the constellation of Centaurus the Centaur. Centaurus was one of the 48 constellations listed by the 2nd century astronomer Ptolemy, observing from Alexandria in Egypt, but it can be traced back to Babylonian times. While Centaurus is now very much a southern constellation, it once lay close to the equator and has been slowly shifting southwards due to precession for thousands of years. It now covers an area of over 1,000 square degrees, the 9th largest constellation in the sky, but it was once even larger and incorporated the constellations of Lupus as an animal caught by the centaur and Crux, the Southern Cross, as part of the centaur's legs. Because of its position along the Milky Way, it contains a large number of bright stars, with over 280 over magnitude 6.5 and 10 brighter than magnitude 3. The constellation also contains a number of interesting star clusters and nebulae. The globular cluster Omega Centauri, sat just to the east of the bright band of our galaxy, is perhaps the most famous, and is easily visible to the naked eye at magnitude 3.7. This is by far the largest and brightest globular cluster in the Milky Way, with a luminosity greater than a million suns. Omega Centauri measures around 150 light years across and contains several million mainly yellow dwarf stars. As with most globular clusters, these stars are incredibly old, with an average age of 12 billion years. The cluster is relatively easy to find, even with the naked eye, appearing as a fuzzy star around 13 degrees, that's a little more than the width of your fist at arm's length, northeast of Gamma Crucis at the top of the Southern Cross. In fact, Omega Centauri was originally thought to be a star and was given the Bayer designation Omega as the 24th brightest in the constellation. Unaided, it appears to cover around half a degree when seen in a clear, dark sky. Through binoculars, it is an even more stunning sight, spanning almost a full degree of the sky, twice that of the full moon. With a telescope, the cluster becomes a glowing, shimmering ball of stars, with many individual stars visible towards the outskirts of the cluster. As well as being exceptionally large and bright, Omega Centauri appears to have formed more slowly than other globular clusters, with two independent periods of star formation over 2 billion years. Because of this, some astronomers have suggested that it may be the remains of a dwarf galaxy that was absorbed into the Milky Way billions of years ago. Further east and low on the horizon after dark is the constellation of Virgo, with its brightest star Spica rising just as twilight ends at the start of the month. By the end of the month, it's rising just after sunset. Spica is actually a particular type of binary system called a rotating ellipsoidal variable, where its two components orbit so close together that they become egg-shaped rather than spherical. The components can only be separated by observing their spectra and looking for the tiny shifts caused by the two stars orbiting each other. At around 250 light-years, Spica is one of the closest massive binary star systems to our Sun. Virgo is also home to the Virgo cluster of galaxies, containing perhaps as many as 2,000 members, so this part of the sky is particularly galaxy-rich, and we will be exploring some of these objects further in the coming months as the constellation gets higher in our evening sky. The Virgo cluster forms the core of the larger Virgo supercluster, of which our local group of galaxies is also a part. But there's another reason to look towards Virgo this month. Just below and to the left of Spica is bright golden Jupiter, now becoming the dominant planet in our evening skies as Venus disappears in the dusk sky. The nearly full moon will pass close by on the 14th and 15th of the month. With a decent pair of binoculars, you should be able to pick out Jupiter's four largest moons, Io, Europa, Ganymede and Callisto. Known as the Galilean moons, they were first spotted when Galileo turned his newly invented telescope to the sky over 400 years ago. The discovery of these moons orbiting another celestial body provided some of the first solid evidence that the Earth was not in fact the center of everything, with the whole known universe orbiting around it. Wishing you clear skies from the team at Space Place at Carter Observatory here in the center of New Zealand.